Chapter 4. Side Effects. Chasing a calorie deficit is a fool's game. Footnote. This particularly colorful phrasing of the problem is not mine, but that of Ken Berry, a family physician in rural Tennessee and author of the book Lies My Doctor Told Me. If fattening implies, as it does, that we merely accumulate every day in our fat cells some tiny percentage of all the fat calories we consume, plus whatever carbohydrates happen to be converted into fat, what are we expected to do about it? Isn't that the critical, key, obvious question? The orthodox thinking is that we eat less, exercise portion control, maybe leave the table hungry. By a variation on the same mathematics that von Norden used more than a century ago, dietitians will patiently explain to those who are overweight or obese that if they eat 500 calories a day fewer than they prefer or are currently consuming, they will lose a pound a week. 1,000 calories fewer will mean 2 pounds. They will advise women to eat 1,200 to 1,500 calories total each day, and men to target between 1,500 and 1,800, as the website of the National Heart, Lung, and Blood Institute now does. The thinking is that if we cut back sufficiently on how much we eat, surely we will get that excess fat out of our bodies, regardless of how seemingly trivial the overeating might have been that produced that fat. In the 1960s and 70s, these calorie-restricted diets were often known, even in the research literature, as semi-starvation diets. I'm going to use that terminology because it is entirely appropriate. This assumption that people will lose weight if they are starved sufficiently is certainly true. This is one reason clinical researchers and physicians from Newberg onward were so convinced that we get fat because we eat too much. Cut back enough on the calories a fat person is allowed to eat, and the result is a less fat person. But as the Harvard psychologist William Sheldon observed in the late 1940s, starving a fat man, an endomorph in his terminology, doesn't actually turn him into a lean man, an ectomorph, or a muscular, athletic one, a mesomorph, any more than starving a mastiff turns it into a collie or a greyhound. For the dogs, you get an emaciated mastiff. For the humans, an emaciated fat man. So this thinking, too, has some serious problems that have to be ignored to embrace it. If you put a lean person on a semi-starvation diet, you also get a less fat person, actually an emaciated lean person. Starving or semi-starving a growing child will result in an emaciated child whose growth is stunted. But no authority would ever assume, let alone state publicly, that children grow because they eat more than they expend. At least, I hope not. Yet that's always been considered the reasonable interpretation of the starve a fat man observation. The important question, however, is why it is that some of us have to be chronically starved or semi-starved, exercise portion control, and be hungry for a lifetime, to be lean, or at least leaner, and others don't. This is another question that is rarely asked. Ultimately, the question that can be easily answered, and that certainly should be asked of anyone who suggests we can regain a healthy weight by eating less, let alone that this way is ordained by the laws of physics, is at what cost? What are the side effects? What are the negative sequelae, as doctors with a fondness for Latin terminology would call them? We care about the side effects of any drug therapy for a disease. Does it give us headaches, make us drowsy or dizzy? Do we get abdominal pains or cramps, nausea and vomiting, diarrhea, erectile dysfunction? If we take a drug to lower our cholesterol and it makes our muscles ache unbearably, we're going to find another way, or at least another drug, to do that job. So what about dietary therapy and eating less specifically? Imagine that we voluntarily decide to accept, as Keyes suggested and Newberg implied, that eating less is indeed an absolute requirement for weight loss and then continued weight maintenance. We aim to cut back sufficiently so that we become relatively lean and stay that way for a lifetime. What might that entail? What are the common side effects? What will we have to endure? The authorities know the answer to this question, which may be why they rarely, if ever, ask it. The relevant seminal study the one that has stood for decades as incontrovertible evidence, such as there is in nutrition research, was conducted in the early 1940s by Ansel Keys. He and his colleagues then wrote a two-volume tome, nearly 1,400 pages total, about all that they had learned. The title, The Biology of Human Starvation, immediately tells us a little about what he did and what the experience must have been like for the experimental subjects, who provided the answer to the question of what happens if we try to live with the kind of caloric deprivation that the authorities often argue is necessary for significant weight loss. Put simply, we get hungry, exceedingly so. The best definition of food deficiency, as Keyes and his colleagues wrote in The Biology of Human Starvation, is to be found in the consequences of it. In the early years of World War II, Keyes and his University of Minnesota collaborators enlisted 36 conscientious objectors for the experiment. Most of these young men were lean. A few were heavy, at least by the standards of that considerably leaner era. Keyes and his collaborators fed them roughly 1,600 calories daily of what would today be considered a very healthy, if very boring, diet. Whole wheat bread, potatoes, cereals, and considerable amounts of turnips and cabbage, with token amounts of meat and dairy. It was a low-fat diet, as nutritionists would call it, low in saturated fat, surely, so it was right in line with the dietary guidelines of most 21st century health organizations. The calorie level would put it well within the range recommended for weight loss today. For the first 12 weeks, the men lost an average of a pound of body fat a week. But this slowed to a quarter pound weekly for the next 12, despite the continued deprivation. In total, that's an average of 15 pounds of fat shed over almost half a year. Not bad, although certainly not all that great, keeping in mind that these men did not have that much excess weight to lose. This, however, was not their only response. The men felt continually cold. Their metabolism slowed. Their hair fell out. They lost their libidos. They threw tantrums and thought obsessively about food day and night. Semi-starvation neurosis, the Minnesota researchers called it. 4 developed character neurosis, which was more severe. 2 of those had breakdowns, one with weeping, talk of suicide, and threats of violence. He was committed to a psychiatric ward. The personality deterioration of the other culminated in 2 attempts at self-mutilation. The first time, he nearly cut off the tip of one finger with an axe. When that didn't get him released from the study, he accidentally chopped off 3 fingers. That's quite a price to pay for eating a healthy, mostly plant, whole food, low-fat diet of 1,600 calories a day. When these men were allowed, at the end of the study, to eat to satiety, they consumed prodigious amounts of food, up to 10,000 calories a day. They regained weight and fat remarkably fast. After 20 weeks of recovery, they averaged 50% fatter than when they started. They had post-starvation obesity, as Keyes and his colleagues called it. Many of us have been there. We can relate. So we know that lean, healthy people can't live with this kind of calorie restriction, not if they have any choice. Why expect a fat person to do it? In fact, you can ask any lean friends you might have, in all seriousness, what they would do if their goal in life, or just for a single day, was actually to make themselves hungry, to build up an appetite and keep it up. Tell them to imagine that they are invited to a feast that night. One with the best food they'll ever eat, course after course after course. Tell them their goal is to come hungry and bring an appetite. Ask them what they do to make sure that happens. I'm willing to bet that they'll suggest that they start by eating less during the day, skipping snacks, and reducing their portion sizes when they do eat. And they'll probably also decide that exercising will help, or exercising more, going for longer walks or hikes, burning more calories on the elliptical machine at the gym. In short, eating less, exercising more. This again should tell us that we have to rethink our approach to preventing and curing obesity, that we need a different paradigm to understand how we get fat and how to lose that fat. The very same things that any reasonably sane, lean person would do to build up an appetite, that is, to get hungry and stay hungry, happen to be the very same two things that we tell those who have excess fat to do to lose weight. And these are direct implications of the idea that people with obesity begin life just like lean people, then eat too much, that obesity is an energy balance problem rather than a hormonal one. Of course, if those of us who are fat did try to subsist on, say, 1,600 calories every day, but failed to sustain it because we were, well, continuously, chronically, cut our fingers off to escape it hungry, just as lean people would be, if we failed to maintain the necessary monitoring of our portion sizes and the daily exercising along with it, and now our pre-starvation obesity manifested as post-starvation obesity, we would get blamed for lacking willpower. We would get blamed for committing the sins of gluttony and sloth, ignorance and self-indulgence. We would be told we were just not thinking enough to realize we should be eating not too much, or at least should have been eating not too much all along. Many responses come to mind, but they are, regrettably, unprintable.